Morning, everybody. Good morning. This is my last talk on the San Do Kai, which is the harmony of separation and oneness. From the 8th century, Sekito is the teacher who wrote this poem. So here are the last few lines, which I'm going to talk about today. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Progress is not a matter of far or near, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. I respectfully urge you who study the mystery, do not pass your days and nights in vain. Do not pass your days and nights in vain. Very famous quote that's echoed throughout the literature, starting with Sekito and all the way to, I guess, to me. Why not? So, life is short, and if we pass our days and nights in vain, it just goes by, and we miss out. We miss out. Trying to find things that we authentically want to do is pretty important, that express our authenticity is pretty important, that connect us to ourselves and to some deeper reality is pretty important. And it's not an easy thing to do, and it takes some quieting of the mind, really, to sort of get in touch with what we really love to do, and then to have some faith that we can manifest that. To find our separate, authentic voice and do it against all odds, and then die happy. Die happy. What a deal. What a deal. Takes courage. Takes courage. And Suzuki Roshi called this expression of your inmost request, sort of really discovering what your inmost request is. And he never explained that. And I tried to explain it to Wanda, but I failed. I can't explain it. Come on in. Have a seat. So, in my life now, I'm kind of blessed because I've got three things that I love to do that are expression of maybe my inmost request. One is teaching Zen, practicing Zen with folks. Second is helping people with mental illness, which comes also from deep in my heart. And third is my grandchildren. I got that more recently. It just was bestowed on me with no effort of my own. But that's only one side of life, isn't it? It's a great side of life. But sometimes we get things to do that we don't love. We get things on our plate, laid on our plate, that we don't love. So then, the Soto Zen phrase, or at least my Soto Zen phrase, is love what we do. Love what we do. What we're given to us. I mean, that's a real practice, isn't it? So my friend MK, for years, she worked with people with AIDS as a social worker, then as a caretaker, as they would deteriorate, doing stuff that social workers generally don't do with them, helping with their meals and their cooking and all that stuff, because she had a couple of sons who were gay, and she knew she was really empathic with AIDS, so that was something that she was really doing what she loved for years. And she decided to take early retirement because another thing that she loved to do was be with her husband, and he was 10 years older than her, and he'd retired and be with her grandkids. So she retired at 55. And then what happened? Life. A month later, her husband showed signs of Alzheimer's. A month after she retired. And his Alzheimer's deteriorated, has been deteriorating very quickly. So you can't exactly say she's doing what she loves. She certainly didn't love or plan to caretake her own husband of 45 years. Certainly, but her practice, and she's a practitioner. There it is. To love what she does. Difficult practice for human beings. Whether it's Zen or Catholicism or atheism, difficult for us. But it's what we're given sometimes. It's what we're given. And let's not pass our days or nights in vain when we're given something. So Sekito says, the way is right before us. Progress is not a matter of far or near. So with MK, the way is right there. I mean, taking care of Charles. And not just entirely taking care of Charles, but taking care of herself as she's taking care of Charles, because she can't leave herself out. She can't leave herself out. And her grandkids, who think, Grandpa's getting weird. Well, and the whole family mobilizes as best they can. The ray right before them. Progress is not a matter of far or near. If it is, then we all get so despairing. We get all entangled. But if we see the way right before us, it's what's happening. It's life. It's not bad. It's not good. And we can just be with it. Fully engaged. So we do our best without getting entangled, as I've been talking about. Entangled in how can this be happening to me? What's going to be next? How am I going to do this when it gets worse? When will I have to do a nursing home? Tangled. We don't need to get entangled if we just stay with the way, stay on the way, which is right before us. Right before us. But hard. We have to bring ourselves back. We have to bring ourselves back. And really not hard if we just bring ourselves back. But when we think about it, we just get profane. At least I do. Get really profane. That's okay. Just be with my profanity. Just be with it. The way is right before me. And without, on the other hand, as I've been talking, without disengagement, without checking out. MK has not checked out. But I'm sure she's thought about it a lot of times. Check out mentally, check out emotionally, and check out literally. But she hasn't done it. Because she's a pretty sincere practitioner. So, this practice that we do calls for some perseverance. Perseverance with equanimity. So I want to talk a little bit today about equanimity, which is the fourth of the four divine abodes. Divine places we can hang out in. Because the way is right before us. Equanimity. Equanimity implies equality, not favoring or rejecting anything, equally regarding everything. And this harmony of separation and oneness is sometimes called the equality of separation and oneness. Equality, equal. Sometimes this is referred to as the absolute middle way. It's absolute because we don't get caught on before or after. Whatever we have here is big reality. Big reality. Which includes before and after too. Doesn't deny those. MK right now is just trying to trying to decide, at least last time I talked to her, trying to think about, well, the next month, the next 6 months, the next year, how am I going to handle that? She's got a part-time home health aide in there now, helping her. But what's it going to be like? When will it? So we have to include before and after in our careful, equanimous attention to this big life, this huge life. And it's a stretch. It's a stretch for us as human beings. I don't care how long you've been sitting. It's a stretch. Sitting helps, for sure. It helps. But it's not the be-all and end-all. There isn't any be-all and end-all. It's just life. It's an aspiration. Rather than something we could have claimed to achieve, I got it. I'm just like the wind, blowing here and there and to and fro and up and down all places. We don't achieve that. We don't achieve that. But any time we just come back to this, the wind is blowing. There's an equanimity there. And this practice that we do is little by little. It takes time. And we have to practice it over and over again. Over and over again. It's not dry neutrality. Oh, that person's so calm. Well, maybe they're really calm, or maybe they're just sort of faking it. It's not dry neutrality. It's not cool aloofness. It's a mature equanimity that comes from this practice. It's pretty mature, pretty adult-like, whatever that means. I don't know. Buddha says a mind filled with equanimity is abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. Without hostility and without ill will. That's our practice. That's our practice. To discover that mind just by loving what we do, by engaging in what we're doing. And sometimes having the wonderful privilege of doing what we love. But who knows how long it'll last? Who knows? But actually, they're not two. If we really give ourselves to this, we love it. We love it. Doesn't matter what it is. In the middle of the pain, in the middle of the sorrow, in the middle of the confusion, there's love. So they're not two. They're not two. So equanimity, which is talked about a lot in the Pali Sutras, two words for equanimity. First is upekkha, which means to look over. To look over. The power of observation, the ability to see without being caught by whatever, my preconceptions, my desires, my worries, my discouragement, not being caught. And when we develop this, it gives rise to a great sense of peace, a great sense of peace, just the practice of looking over, just looking over. Which we call bare awareness in Buddhism, or bare attention, or whatever. What we call it doesn't matter. But even when we practice looking over, doesn't mean we're going to get it right necessarily. You think, oh, I'll practice it and I'll get it right. So, so MK has been practicing doing less zazen than she used to, because she's with Charles more, but still doing zazen, but really trying to practice when she's with him and then breathe in, for in between. She's done pretty good at practicing equanimity, pretty good at practicing looking over, big observation. She made an assessment a couple months ago that Charles could take a plane to see grandkids in Seattle. But he was good enough to do that still. That if they arranged it, they'd be able to work it out. But he could take a plane. And so the whole family mobilized, and MK orchestrated it, and someone, there all the details. I don't know all the details. They started it, and then she got a call from the airport. Charles was being removed from the plane. She had to come pick up Charles. This is what happens in life, isn't it? This is what happens in life, these kinds of things. They happen all the time. They haven't happened to you yet. They will. And so, with equanimity, breathing, she went and picked him up at the airport and brought him home. Now, can she do that without any blame? I mean, she did her best, right? Without any blame? She can. It's possible for us to do that as human beings. Just to be there. Just to be there. Without blaming him, without blaming her. The way is right before us. Right before MK. Progress is not a matter of far or near. It's not. It's not. Right here is the way. And Upeka has a, not only does it mean to look over, it also means the ease that comes from seeing a bigger picture, i.e. grandmotherly love. Grandmotherly love. Reb was here once and talked about, gave six talks on grandmotherly love. Comes right from the Pali Canon. Grandmotherly love. Why grandmotherly? Well, obvious, right? You know how parents get all entangled. And maybe you haven't been a parent. Well, you had a parent, so you know how parents get all entangled. You know how grandmas, at least the best ones, can just be there, can just be on the way with a grandchild without trying to tune them up continually. You need a tune-up. I won't take you to the movies unless you get tuned up. Grandmotherly love. Grandmotherly love. The ease that comes from seeing a bigger picture. A big picture. A huge picture. Not caught up in the drama of whether my grandson is going to behave okay when he comes to visit me for a month soon. My two grandchildren. Wow. It doesn't say grandfatherly, though. It says grandmotherly. Interesting, isn't it? What's the deal there? I guess the image is that grandmothers are more emotionally available, I think. I think that would be the image. Now, I don't think that's necessarily the case, but that's the image. So as Charles has deteriorated, MK now, as I said, has a home health aide in, some hours a day, key hours, and now she's going to have one for a long time, a lot of hours, and I don't know if the family can afford it, so we don't know how long he's, you know how these things go, we don't know, but she's doing her best, and so last week she was showing the home health aide, how to lay out Charles's depends. This is her husband. This is her husband for 45 years. So if she dwells on that memory, I mean, she's going to grieve. Grieving is part of this. The way includes grieving, doesn't it? It includes pain, doesn't it? But in the moment, she's showing the home health aide how to put out the depends just in the moment, and there's great warmth there in just doing it and being available, and some spaciousness in just doing that. So that's one word for equanimity, upeka, Another word for equanimity in Pali is, this is one hard one for me to do, tatrama jatatra. Tatrama jatatra. To stand in the middle of all this. To stand in the middle of all this. All this stuff that's going on in our lives, in our world. Just to stand in the middle. Just to balance. Just to balance. Just to remain centered in the middle of what is ever happening. Upright. Or maybe not always upright. Maybe going back and forth and up and down, but coming back to the upright position naturally and easily. Like a ballast keeps a ship upright in strong winds. And through our meditation practice, we develop an inner strength. It just happens. If you mess with it and think you're not doing good at it, you won't develop your inner strength. Because you'll be grumbling to yourself the whole time about, oh, I'm not making any progress. Then you remind yourself, progress is not a matter of far or near. The way is before us, within us, around us. We remind ourselves over and over again. That's why we have these 10,000 scriptures, all these books, right, to remind us. Not about learning something new. We already know pretty well. We have enough knowledge to last a few lifetimes. This is reminding us how to be in the world. With simplicity, with openness, with joy. Tatrama jatatra, to stand in the middle of all this. So, in my first or second talk on the harmony of separation and oneness, I talked about the common Hawaiian metaphor of the rafter in the house. The rafter in the house. To stand in the middle of all this, to balance, to remain centered. So, as I said when I was talking before, these ceiling rafters are fake, so they don't count. But in the YN explanation, which the Sandokai, which the harmony of difference and oneness is based on, the rafter, just by being the rafter, not by trying to be more than a rafter, more than a rafter with knots in it that's a little bent. Not trying to be any different than the rafter that it is. Not trying to worry about how the floor is doing, whether the floor is going to fall away, whether it's doing enough good job of holding up the ceiling. Just by authentically being the rafter, it supports the whole house. It is the whole house. It is the whole house. But if the rafter tries to do anything differently than be the rafter, oh, I'm not a good enough rafter. Right? So this is a central YN metaphor for our lives. By authentically being here, being engaged here, regardless of how messed up things are, just engaged, we support all life. We support all life. All life supports us. There's no gap. No gap. So if we want to practice equanimity, according to the Pali scriptures, we need protection from the 8 worldly winds. The 8 worldly winds. Pray. Okay, so I'm going to go through them. Praise and blame. So for MK, not blaming herself for the plane deal supports and promotes her equanimity and the whole family's equanimity. Everybody in the family experiences her just saying, oh, we made a mistake, did our best, and then everybody's relaxed. Nobody blames grandma or thinks they've done it. Everybody's relaxed. Have you ever noticed that? when there's no blame, how it relaxes everyone, everyone around you? Praise and blame, number one and two. Success and failure, three and four. Protection from success and failure. If she worries very much about success, I mean, he's deteriorating. How do you measure success with a person whose Alzheimer's is going like this? If she's going to be equanimous, she's got to just not hang out in that worldly wind, not be tossed away by that worldly wind, and instead breathe. That's not the worldly wind. That's the Buddha wind. Just breathing. Just breathing. Pleasure and pain, number five and number six. Fame and disrepute, number seven and number eight. And MK is really good at the disrepute one. I've just moved. Because, you see, this fellow, and of course these names are not the right names. These people are protected. Their identities are protected. But anyway, disrepute. Well, this fellow was a college professor. Before that, he had been, before he met MK, a Catholic priest. He was very involved in the community. So, for many people, she would not want to take him out in public anymore. She would not want old friends to see him. But she is really practicing, just spontaneously, I think, what I call Zen beyond self-consciousness. Because I was at a party recently, and there was Charles and MK. Now, Charles, he's not so disoriented. He makes a ruckus. He's just sort of there, and he looks a little confused. He doesn't say much, and he smiles. This guy was a professor. And she, you know, he goes out to dinner with the family. She takes him to social events. And she says, I guess she's his grandma now. She's his grandma. I don't know. Now, if I told her that, she would say, she'd probably throw something at me. Because she doesn't think in that way. She doesn't think in it. So if our sense of inner well-being is independent of the eight winds, then we remain on an even keel. Things knock us over, and we come back. And they knock us over, and we come back. Because the way is right before us. And equanimity in the Pali scriptures has two enemies, the near enemy and the far enemy. So the near enemy of equanimity is stupid indifference, lukewarm neutrality. Not an act of eyes wide open, regard for all beings. Not a capacity to have equanimity regardless of what happens. A stupid indifference, a lukewarm neutrality. So, when my father was dying, which was, I don't know how many years ago, 8, 9 years ago maybe, well, he wasn't actually dying yet. He wasn't dying. He was living in a little kind of board and care home and being taken care of. And he was actually, he seemed to have all his faculties pretty much intact. But my sister didn't go to visit him very much. My sister lives in the town that I'm from on the West Coast. She didn't go to visit him very much. And she said, well, it's hard to be there. He won't say anything to me. He just lies there like he's in a coma. They tell me he's not in a coma, but he just lies there. It's hard. And I thought to myself, oh, geez. I kind of blamed my sister. I thought, I didn't say anything to her. Run around. She can't even be with her own dad. Well, then I went out there. I went out there. The great Zazen hero, right? I can sit for a week. I can sit for a week on this cushion, no problem. I go out there, I go into the little home in Redwood City to sit next to my dad. My dad doesn't respond. I'm getting kind of pissed. They say he's not in a coma. Where did my equanimity go? Where did my equanimity go? Now I'm blaming him. First I'm blaming my sister, now I'm blaming him. Come on. Come on. How quickly we as human beings fall into this. Isn't it interesting? Can we just notice it when it happens? Can we just notice it with some kindness to ourselves? Because we're all in the same predicament. It's exactly the same for all of us, regardless of how much meditation you do. The difference about meditation is that we become much more sensitized, much more aware. And when we're more aware and more sensitized, then there's a possibility we can always come back and just be in love with whatever is in front of us. Just be in love with my dad who stubbornly refused to look at us because he didn't want us putting us. We decided he was just doing this to spite us. Well, that was our decision, right? So that's the near enemy of equanimity, stupid indifference, lukewarm neutrality, which is what my sister did when she would sit by him because she got exhausted by trying to get him to do anything, and then which I started doing too. But then I would bring myself back, and I would just try to be aware of him, try to be aware of his breathing, try to be aware of the bed. And if I can do it facing a wall, I should be able to do it with my own dad, right? But it's human situation is more complicated than that. They're all the emotions that come up that don't come up facing the wall. Well, maybe they do come up facing the wall, but different type of emotions. Complicated, this life. But not complicated, very simple. The way is right before us. Right before us. So the far enemy of equanimity is attachment or aversion. That is partial seeing. Fragmented, isolated, painful. I only see this part of it. I only see this part of it. Entirely different flavor than equanimity. Entirely different feeling tone from equanimity. Because that's a calmness, that fragmented calmness is based on ignoring something or avoiding something. Sure, it gets us through. But then we're living our lives in vain. We're only half alive. We're only a quarter alive. If we want to live our lives fully, we can bring ourselves back to just loving what we do. And right in the middle of the sorrow, right in the middle of the pain, right in the middle of the confusion, we can be generous and trustworthy without taking sides. We notice our sides and then we come back. Understanding the way that is right before us. So, but you know, when we practice this, it's good to go beyond the world, words, even to forget the word. The words can help us practice a little bit. They should help us. But then we forget the words and we practice with the nameless feeling as a physical feeling in the breath, in the body, in the just heartbeat. That's the way we practice it. And if we do that, we can develop deep concentration in our zazen and deep concentration when we're showing the home health aide how to put on our lover's depends. Deep concentration. Concentration which is one-pointed, still, and available. Available to all life. So this is the message of the Sandokai. This is the message of the harmony of separation and oneness. The individual, as individuals, engaging in activity after activity. We're undivided from everything if we do it equanimously, if we do it one-pointedly. And when we don't do it equanimously, we just bring ourselves back. So now I want to do a guided meditation, which I know some of you don't like guided meditations, but this does come from the ancient Pali. So maybe that will impress some of you. Maybe not. Maybe not. And I need a bell. Thank you, Karen. So this is a guided meditation in equanimity. And I'll ring the bell once, and we'll start with the body and breath. Then I'll ring the bell once at the end of each of two steps. I'm doing a short version of what is quite long. Okay, so just get in a comfortable posture and close your eyes three quarters of the way or all the way, however you want to do it. Return to the feeling of your body and your breathing. Your body and your breathing. Feel the awareness. If there are thoughts coming into the mind or the mind is dull, notice the space around the thoughts. Notice the space around the dullness. Be with the awareness itself and use the body and the breathing as a way of staying with the awareness itself. The first step is to practice with the word inseparable. Just drop that word into the awareness and breathe with that word, inseparable. Inseparable. And when you're ready, you can let go of that word and just breathe with that feeling. Next, let's breathe while contemplating the thought, whatever arises, every thought, every word, every deed, every appearance arises from causes and conditions. There are only causes and conditions. Whatever arises, every thought, every word, every deed, every appearance arises from causes and conditions. There are only causes and conditions. Now we will continue to sit contemplating this thought. All beings are just like me. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. All beings are just like me. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. Please follow along with these thoughts as best you can. Begin by bringing to mind someone you really love, an uncomplicated love and positive regard. Let yourselves really feel the warmth of that love and attachment you feel to this person. So where does that positive, wonderful feeling come from? It comes from your interactions with that person, which have been mostly positive and beneficial for you. It comes from the feelings that you have inside based on those reactions and experiences. But where did all that come from? It came from causes and conditions. If causes and conditions did not bring you and this person together at the same time and at the same place, if these causes and conditions didn't apply, you wouldn't feel this way. It could have been other causes and conditions. And the person that you now feel so affectionate toward could have been another person. This is not to take away the positive feeling. Just reflect on the true root of those positive feelings. It's not really the person. It's love itself. The endless play of causes and conditions that make up the world. That's the actual cause of your positive feeling, not the person. The cause is the love that is the world, that is in you, and that is reality itself. This is equanimity. Now think of a hostile person, somebody you really don't appreciate. Maybe someone you know now, maybe somebody in your past, maybe somebody from years ago. Really let yourself feel your enmity, your dislike, your disgust for this person. Don't hold back. Don't be a good Buddhist. Just feel what you feel. If you are avoiding this one, don't avoid it. Take a breath and plunge in. Even though you don't like feeling this close to this nasty person. So what is the cause of this yucky feeling? It isn't some essence in this person. It's things he or she did. Deeds, words, thoughts. And where did they come from? How did they appear? They are the result of causes and conditions. They are the natural fruits of causes and conditions. Things happened in that person's life that led them to say and do the kinds of things they say and do. The real object of your dislike or hatred is not the person. It's the bad causes and conditions that have given rise to these behaviors. If there had been other causes and conditions, this same person might be your good friend, like the first person that you thought of, whom you are so close to or love so much. And I wonder if it's possible for you to transfer whatever enmity or dislike or fear you have from the person to the causes and conditions. I wonder if it's possible to vow to yourself to use the energy of that dislike, that enmity, that fear, to overcome such causes and conditions, first in yourself and then in all others whom you meet. Use the very energy of your hurt and your dislike to overcome these bad causes and conditions in you and everybody else that you meet. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings without exception and all beings equally enjoy loving kindness, joy, and compassion. May you personally dedicate the rest of your life and beyond to see to it that this wish comes about, that it becomes real. Even though I can't hope to accomplish this now, this week, this month, this decade, or even during the rest of my life, I'm determined. I'm determined. Even after my life is over, my life energy will go on to continue to contribute to this goodness as long as time will last. Let's make that vow to ourselves if we can. This is a great equanimity. Great equanimity. Okay, when we're ready, let's just come back to our breathing and our posture. Let's let all of that go. You can feel how just in sitting here with your own wonderful presence, you're undivided from all of life. It doesn't really need any of these words, any of these ideas. It's here anyway. Just feel it. Breathe it. Enjoy it for a moment or two. Allow yourself to appreciate that you're perfectly okay as you are. You can let go of others' expectations and any thoughts of being someone different and appreciate your undividedness from all life right now. The more you accept yourself as you are, the more connection you can feel to the vast, spacious, and wonderful flow of life, which is never apart from you. Does anybody have any questions or comments or anything they would like to tell us about? Yeah.
Two things came up for me when you talked about the way it went for us. One is a couple of decades ago, I'm in therapy, the notion of don't stay in therapy too long, too much analysis versus synthesis came up, and the therapist made an offhand remark and said, well, life is the best therapist. Huh. And paying attention to this moment is an opportunity.
Huh.
Be there.
Good.
Yet just as much.
Good for you. Good for you. Mm-hmm. Thanks. What else? Yeah. You're going to murder it?
It reminds me, when you first talked, there's another saying, I think it's from Buddha, that delusion is a child playing in a house and girls should destroy it while the house burns down the mountain. And then it says, don't waste the time.
Pardon?
Thought about that way at the beginning when you did the quote. I carried that with me. Basically, just not wasting time.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. The last thing you said.
I've carried that with me. That's saying.
And has it been helpful to you?
Yeah.
Good.
Because I do sometimes catch myself being that child and gross through the toilet.
Could you guys hear him? He said that, I'm paraphrasing, so correct me. He said that he's carried with him the analogy, which actually comes from the Buddhist scriptures, of a child playing with his toys when the house is burning down, as a reminder to bring himself back to just being present. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah.
And, you know, we each need our own reminders. We each need to find out this is about our own authenticity. So his reminders might not work for you at all. They may seem, his reminder sounds good to me, but it might sound strange to you. But you can figure, you can decide, you can, for yourself, what your reminders are. What reminders will really help you. And you need them. You need them. You can't do this practice without them.
Well, it seems to make sense when you talk about it. And then there's, going back to your life. With nuclear family issues.
Yeah.
You know, perhaps you can understand that it was because of causes and conditions that this person is so kind of in their abusive.
Yeah.
And yet you still have this family.
Yes.
I'm wondering then, you recognize this and then you, like, try as much to, you know, recognize that and move on, or, you know, kind of ignore it, or, do you know what I'm saying?
It's confusing, isn't it?
It is.
It's very confusing. It's very confusing. Yeah, yeah. What I've been talking about in my talks the last few times is noticing when you want to just run or whether you just want to cut off, and trying to bring yourself back just to being engaged, and then noticing when you're getting entangled on the other hand, and try to bring yourself back, because it's human nature to want to balance between entanglement and running away, entanglement and disengagement, entanglement and avoiding shutting down. But the middle way is that we do, the way is right before us, is engagement. But let's not make too much of a thing about it, because that's just a word. It's bringing ourselves back, bringing ourselves back. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's confusing. Confusing. But we...
Fight or flight. I don't know. To bring ourselves back to being engaged.
To just being here with our feelings, with our concerns, with our activity, and without being entangled in all the thoughts, all the worries about how these people are going to affect me, and without at the same time running away as much as possible. Although sometimes we have to run away. That's okay. And sometimes we are going to get entangled. That's okay. But bringing ourselves back to center, to still, equanimous center, which doesn't require anything other than gentle determination to just coming back. But this dysfunction may be so severe that you have to not see the family member for a while. And then you're just bringing yourself back to your acknowledgement that that's what you need to do to stay equanimous. Rather than, you should have this, Tim's told me about engagement, I got to figure out how to do this right. This is not a question of right. It's a question of openness to what's going on, and kind consideration of how we move back and forth between getting all blown away by everything these people do, to, I'm out of here. I never want to have anything to do with them again. We do that. That's our Darwinian need, our fight or flight need. Remember, I've been talking in these talks about the amygdala, right? That's what the amygdala does. So we need an amygdala. That's that's in the brainstem, right? That's developed a gazillion years ago, right? We need that to protect ourselves, but it's not the whole picture of the amygdala. Yeah.
Loving kindness does not mean not protecting oneself or others when that's necessary.
Exactly. Exactly. That would be trying to cut the amygdala out of our brain.
And not just the amygdala. I mean, there are higher functions as well.
That's right.
In order to make plans, to
right.
figure out how to deal
that's
with real problems.
Very important.
Which cause suffering.
Very important. Planning. Strategizing, being shrewd. This is not the opposite of being shrewd.
And acting,
yes. What do you mean by acting, though?
Not just developing the plan, but actually
actualizing it.
Your body and
actualizing.
Actually doing
yeah.
things.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking.
Exactly. Problem, yes. This is so important because we create a new ideal for ourselves, the ideal of sort of loving kindness, and then it cements our activity, and we don't protect ourselves anymore. So, very good. Thank you for bringing that up. If we don't protect ourselves, how can we be do loving kindness?
Yeah. We list off the 8 worldly things.
Sure. I should be able to remember them, but I can't, so... I can remember probably 6 or 7 of them. But I have to find them. Oh, yes. Okay. Praise and blame. Praise, blame, success, failure, pleasure, pain, fame, and disrepute. Yeah.
So when she was talking about, someone that you really have a bad taste in your mouth.
Yeah.
I really didn't think of anybody in my immediate family or friends or in my life that I could really think of. But I went to the person that did the mass murders.
Oh. Yeah.
I mean, that's just,
yeah.
So when something like that comes, like, do you just bear witness to that? Or that just gives me the heebie-jeebies? You know, like, how do you process that?
As much as possible, you try to bear witness in your zazen. I mean, and a zazen isn't just sitting facing a wall, but in your consciousness. Oh, I feel whatever you feel. Maybe you feel panicky. Maybe you feel pain. Maybe you feel empathy. Maybe you feel disgust. You bear witness to that. Yeah, exactly.
Would you bear witness to that?
I know it doesn't. It's not supposed to feel. I mean, yeah. And sometimes maybe you just have to veg out. But whenever we can, we come back to just being open to it. Whenever we can. But let's not be foolishly vulnerable. Sometimes we need to protect. Sometimes we've had something happen recently that means that we have to keep a boundary when we see that. We need to not look at that paper or hear about that because it will affect our equanimity. So we're not ready to bear witness.
But isn't that something that you want to kind of push through and do anyway?
Little by little, gently with loving kindness, but not as some kind of project that you're going to be a better person. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Forget trying to be a better person. Of course, we all want to be a better person. But you know, we so overdo it. We so overdo it. We're a better person by paying attention to this way here and being on it. Being on it, being in it. You know, if we turn it into a project, then our loving kindness for ourselves is gone. The moment I turn into, this is my project of, even though I don't feel like it, I got to open the paper and read about this, turn on the television. This is good practice for me. We're not being loving kind to ourselves. We left ourselves out. If loving kindness doesn't start at home, then what is it? What is it? If the individual doesn't take care of, Tim doesn't take care of Tim, how can he feel all life? How can he feel connected to all life? No way. No way. But Tim has to remind himself because he wants to be a good boy. He wants to be a good Zen teacher. Whatever. You know, if I'm a good Zen teacher, I should really be able to go into this, right? Instead of say to my wife, I don't want to hear anything about it. I just got back from people yelling at me for an hour. I probably won't want to hear about it for a week or 6 months, Linda, okay? That's my wife. and if she's doing her practice, she'll say, you had a hard day. Yeah. I'll put that away and we won't bring it up again. Yeah. Anything more?
Once the ball of wax, it could probably take you.
Pardon?
It's a huge thing to figure out, but I'm trying to balance what you're saying about being open to everything and looking over everything, but still you talking about boundaries.
Yes.
It being okay to run away?
Yes. Well, that's why this is the oneness of the individual and the undivided. If you don't take care of the individual, you're in your body, I'm in mine, there's not a real appreciation of undividedness. I have my issues, you have yours.
Because what you were talking about with a bad situation with a family member, if you just, being open to everything is fine and good, but if you stand there and just let them throw rocks at you, eventually bad things were going to happen to you and you're going to be in the hospital. So
exactly.
I guess I always thought that, when you talk about remaining engaged, when you talk about being present and remaining open without disengaging, but then you say it's okay to run away, I'm trying to unravel that.
Well, when you run away, then you just run away. You just do it. That's being on the way to protect yourself.
You're not really engaging.
No, and you're engaging in running away. You're engaging in self-protection. You're engaging in taking care of the individual, of your individual needs at the moment by running. If you really do that, you will come back at some point. You will come back. Now, you may not come, you're not going to be a fool. You won't come back to somebody who is threatening to harm you, but you'll come back to your feelings of confusion about that, or wanting to avoid that person. You'll come back to those feelings at some point. But running away is fine. When you run away, just run away. This is good Zen practice. Monica.
Just to follow up on that, I think that sometimes when you engage because you think it's what you're supposed to do or to live up to a certain ideal, it's a way of disengaging from yourself.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So there's different levels of engagement. And so it's cutting off your innate sense of protection or your innate need for yourself, and you're engaging in a way that's you think that's what you're supposed to do, or
that's right.
Somebody wants you to do, or that's what a good person does. So there's different levels of engagement and disengagement.
Or it could be habit.
Interesting way to think
about it. Because it usually leads to resentment and bitterness.
In my experience, if mm-hmm. I do that, then
that's
I don't
right.
make myself later.
Yeah. That's right.
Which means I'm not acting in, you know, I've had to rationalize my brain. I'm really not acting in a loving way if I am doing that, because it does lead to more negative emotions about myself
mm-hmm.
than the other person.
Yes. Yes. Well, this is a very good discussion, but it's time to end for this morning. We will come back. We always come back. If we want to practice, we always come back.